Hello and welcome to Home to Her, the podcast that's dedicated to reclaiming the lost and stolen wisdom of the sacred feminine. I'm your host, Liz Kelly, and on each episode, we explore her stories and myths, her spiritual principles, and most importantly, what this wisdom has to offer us right now. Thanks for being here. Let's get started. Hey, everybody, and welcome to the show. I am Liz, joining you from Central Virginia and the traditional territory of the Monacan Nation. And I'm so glad that you're here. And hey, if you want to know whose indigenous lands you are residing on, you can go to my show notes, because I know I mentioned this at the opening of every show, and I started putting that in the show notes as well. But check out native-land.ca to find out. And then if you can't remember that, just check out the show notes. Before we get into this, I also have some exciting news that I want to share with you all. My book, Home to Her, Walking the Transformative Path of the Sacred Feminine. I hope you're not tired of hearing me talk about this. Anyways, it's won a 2023 Gold Nautilus Award, which I'm kind of crazy excited about. Nautilus Awards are given to books that promote conscious living, spiritual growth, and sustainability. And past recipients include the late Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh, novelist Barbara Kingsolver, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, the astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. So needless to say, this feels like a really big deal to me. I also want to give a shout out to two of my prior podcast guests, Sarah Bowen and Kavita Chinnayan, both of whom won Nautilus Awards in other categories. Pretty cool. I will put all that in the show notes too. And if you're interested in checking out my book, you can find it wherever you buy books, but please consider buying it from my publisher, Womancraft Publishing, which is an amazing small woman-owned business, or order it from your local bookshop. And if you've read it and liked it, will you please let me know? I love just hearing from you. But I'm also super grateful for reviews on Amazon and Goodreads in particular. It really does help get the word out. And the same goes for this podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, please consider leaving it a favorable review. Reviews on iTunes are super helpful, but I will take them anywhere. And I just love hearing your feedback too. So reach out via social media or via my email. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Home to Her. And email is liz@hometoher.com. I'll put all that in the show notes as well. All right, let's get on with the show. So my guest today is another one of those luminaries in the sacred feminine space whose work I've known about for a while now, but who I only very recently had the chance to connect with. And we had a lovely pre-podcast conversation. And I am so excited to get into not only her extensive knowledge of the sacred feminine and her work in this area, but also talk to her about the way that her spiritual path has evolved and is continuing to expand even right now. So let me go ahead and introduce her to you. Karen Tate is a thought leader, speaker, 7 times published author, podcaster, and a social justice advocate. Karen is also a caring economy conversation leader and power of partnership presenter. And she has a certification from Smith College in the psychology of political activism, Women Changing the World. She can also be seen in the award-winning docufilm Femme, Women Healing the World. Karen has been named one of 13 most influential women in goddess spirituality, and she is also the host of the first podcast on this subject that I ever came across, Voices of the Sacred Feminine. And her newest book is Normalizing Abuse, a commentary on our pervasive culture of abuse. Karen, it is an honor to have you with me. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. I enjoy the opportunity to talk about this and you know, plant those seeds and pebbles in the ponds and all of that so that this information goes out there. So thank you for what you're doing, Liz.
Oh, absolutely. It's funny. I'm thinking back now to when I first found out about your work, and we were just saying before we started recording, you don't know what you don't know. And so this whole world of the sacred feminine felt so intriguing to me, but also like, what is this? And is anybody else walking this? And then, you know, when you start to find people on the path, it didn't even cross my mind that I would one day be hosting a podcast and be in conversation with you or so many of the people whose work that I admired. It's just a beautiful thing to have these connections with each other. I find it to be such a welcoming and cross-pollinating and a deeply connected community. So it's just nice to finally have you here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And I totally agree with you. I mean, when I started Voices of the Sacred Feminine, I mean, it was probably, I want to say, I think 13 years ago, maybe. I don't think podcasts were actually called podcasts then. I think they were still at that point called internet radio. And it was such a thrill to me to talk to women whose books changed my life, you know.
Yes.
I mean, and that they were willing to talk to me and, you know, like Rhianne Eisler and, you know, so many of the foremothers out there. And, you know, it's like, well, once you get one, you think, well, maybe I can get her and maybe I can get her. And they were all so incredible because, you know, I don't know that I consciously realized it in the moment, but, you know, we were helping, you know, educate, change the world, because this isn't something you can go take a course on at college, right? You know?
No. So. You're so right. Yes. I also, it's funny too, because I would reach out to people early on. Like, I think Max Deshu was one of my early guests, and I was so nervous sending her an email. And what I realized just in reaching out to a lot of people in this world is that that's a patriarchal story about, you know, are you important enough? Are you big enough? Are you cool enough? Or whatever, you know, like that is a patriarchal story that I largely have not encountered in hosting this show. I won't say never, you know, but for the most part, people are really wanting to connect with each other. And I think it's because exactly what you said, there isn't a college course and it's not always super easy to find each other. So,
yeah, absolutely. I know when I got Noam Chomsky, I was like so afraid then. It was like, I got him. Now what am I going to do?
I didn't know you had Noam Chomsky. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I wish I could go back and redo it again and ask him deeper questions, but I did my best for the time, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh gosh. Yeah. Don't I feel that? I probably feel that about all so many episodes that I've done, but here we are. It's all good.
Okay.
Well, I would love to hear you tell me a little bit about your spiritual background, what your experiences were like growing up from the spiritual perspective. And if there was anything, was it helpful? Was it harmful? Like what was that like for you?
Sure. Well, you know, I grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana, which is the Bible Belt, right? And so I grew up a Catholic. I went to Catholic school until family couldn't afford it. And then I went to public school. And, you know, living there, you're living in a bubble, right? You don't meet anyone for the most part that's not like you. I was surrounded by either Catholics or Baptists. I think there was one Jewish synagogue in the whole city. And forget about anything else, right? I mean, that's like the religious world. And, you know, I have to say that going to Catholic school, I was always intrigued by the nuns and their mysterious sisterhood. And I remember their convent was a few blocks away from where I lived. And when I'd leave school, I'd see it. And I know for a time there, I wanted to actually be a nun. I would actually go to church after school and pray, if you can believe that. I think it's hysterical now. I would go and, you know, ask if that was my path, you know, let me know it. And well, obviously it wasn't my path, but I don't know, that was more my association, I think, with Christianity than much else. I mean, I knew about Jesus, but I was more interested in Mary. I wasn't at the time aware of what a benign figure she was or how she was marginalized in religion. I mean, we aren't taught that, you know?
No,
I mean,
no.
You learn that later.
Yeah, totally.
So no one's more surprised than me that I end up an interfaith minister ordained in a, you know, Clonakilty Castle in Ireland by Lady Olivia Robertson of the Fellowship of Isis. And so now I, you know, in alternative spirituality, I'm legitimately a priestess and a legal minister, right? But it took getting out of that bubble. So we moved to California when I was about 30. And I stumbled onto a class that was a fluff class, but it cracked the door. It was some silly little shallow class about discovering the goddess within. But I had always been interested in ancient cultures, and I, past lives, memories, whatever, I don't know, because it wasn't like I was learning it in school, but I was drawn to Egypt. And I just love the color palette. I loved something about that culture just drew me. And so when I discovered this thing called goddess, I sort of naturally gravitated, I think, to Isis. And that old saying, when the student's ready, the teachers appear, right? I believe it. So I suddenly started meeting women that were in goddess spirituality. And I went from knowing absolutely nothing, and I will also admit right here and now, so that people know, change is possible. I believe when I lived in the South, because I didn't know there was anything wrong with it, I believe I was a racist. I watched Fox News, and all of that stuff that that is so ugly. It was all rationalized, and I had to learn to get out of that belief system. And I did, fortunately. It didn't take very long. And so it was a major transformation. And then before you know it, I mean, I don't know how deeply you want me to go, but as years went by, I started leading sacred tours to sites of goddess in other countries. And that was important, I felt, because growing up here in the United States, we don't have access to these incredible archaeological sites like they have in Europe and the Middle East. And to stand in a place where a goddess was at the center of a culture was profound to me. It took it out of the realm of books and mythology, even spirituality. And it was like, this was real. This was real, I started a not-for-profit. I got my first published book. It was a slippery slope, so for about 30 years, it consumed my life.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, there's a lot there. I do want to say just really quickly, because I was interested in what you said about racism. And you're I having grown up in Georgia, I think it's part of the water that you drink. Like, it's considered very normal. It goes hand in hand with Christianity, has been my experience. At the bare minimum, it's not questioned. It exists. Segregation is very clear in churches, I think. But I'm curious how, if you could just say a little bit more about, was there a correlation for you, like getting on this kind of sacred feminine path, or just that opening up that you think also opened your eyes to seeing the racism?
And also besides the racism, it was as I became a feminist and realized about equality, and so then I looked back and saw how women were marginalized as well. I mean, I didn't have a sense of inequality of women. I didn't know the word patriarchy, I think as I studied goddess spirituality, because of foremothers like Reanne Eisler, who made the pivot from, that groundbreaking Chalice and the Blade book, which I will credit as changing my life, she started to pivot toward the ideas of partnership and caring economics. So it shifted from this. This ancient culture, spirituality, mythology thing into social justice. So then you started to realize that these belief systems you held were toxic. And they weren't just toxic for anybody who wasn't a white male Christian. They were toxic for women and black and brown people and anybody, it seemed like, who wasn't a white male Christian, right? And you start to learn about Carol Christ, why women need the goddess. And, we start to learn about how we, if we don't have goddess to look to know that women are also created in the image of the divine, then we grow up devaluing ourselves, thinking less of ourselves. You know, we allow ourselves to be subordinate to men and their authority, and voila, patriarchy. You know, I think I forgot your question, but did I answer it?
Well, I think you did. And one of the reasons I was asking is because, yeah, I think you did answer it because I was curious. I know for me, in my experience, it's like exploring the sacred feminine was like, it was cracking open a door. And I've been saying this more and more lately that for me, it has nothing to do with dogma or religious beliefs or like, oh, now that I have a set of a belief system that replaces the Christianity that I was grown up with, but it was a cracking open of a door of like, oh, there's more than one way to think here. And then once that door's open, it just gets bigger and bigger and wider and wider. And for me, it was the opening of my own, like understanding my own, and I say oppression gently, because I think as a white woman, it's debatable how oppressed I am in this culture, but understanding just the misogyny that was present all of a sudden made it much clearer for me to be able to see much deeper forms of oppression elsewhere.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, and this sort of, I think, touches on my book a little bit, you know, Normalizing Abuse, because, you know, and I'm sure we'll get into it, but I reached a point where, of course, I knew about patriarchy. I knew about marginalization of women. I learned about oppression, but I feel like I started to peel that onion even deeper because things like, for instance, if you grew up in the South like we did, we normalized racism, right? We normalized all of that. And we're all at a different point. So maybe to somebody, racism is normal. And to somebody else, well, gaslighting, you know, shouldn't be normalized, or the, what the Supreme Court is doing today is abuse, or, I mean, all of these different, you know, corporations using child labor. I mean, there's so many things. I mean, it's hard to even just grab them out of the air, but we are swimming in a culture of abuse that I think has at the heart of it predator capitalism, colonialism, patriarchy, sexism, racism. And, you know, we accept these things as just the way it is. And depending on where you are in the world, what your belief system is, you see it to different degrees or you don't see it. You know, you don't call it abuse. You don't call it exploitation. It's just the way it is, you know?
Yeah.
And I think we've even gotten away from the meaning of language because, for instance, we even throw around, you know, terms like abuse, trauma, rape, all of these things, like we're talking about, you know, apples and oranges and spinach and broccoli. You know, we've lost the depth of what these words even mean. When we see kids blown up with AR-15s, how many people don't stop and think that maybe the reason it's taken so long to identify the kids is because they don't tell us maybe their faces were blown off. You know, we detach ourselves from, and I think in order to survive, we detach ourselves from the depth of the abuse and exploitation out there. And I'd say in the last 5 or 6 years, so many things that were not the norm have become normalized to us. And it happens to us drip by drip by drip by drip, you know? And, you know, I don't know if you want to get into politics, but some people out there have taken ideas that were once unthinkable. And now it's just okay.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Well, and as a mother of school age children, my head is going to that too, and how it's considered normal to not in my children's school, they're not doing this, but normal in most schools, I think, for children to practice my kids do practice this, active shooter drills. And this is just, okay, well, this is the world we live in. So now we're going to normalize that children need to be prepared from kindergarten that they might be murdered in their classroom. And it's just the way of the world. So that's what we're going to do. Or I just learned the other day, I know I see you want to say something and I want you to say it. I'm just going to lose this thought though. But I just learned the other day, a friend was saying or posting somewhere online that I believe it's her middle school child or high school child. There's only one bathroom that is now available to all the kids in the school. Like I guess per gender, because so many of the kids were doing drugs and vaping in the bathrooms that they've now locked all the other bathrooms. So there's only one bathroom available. And, you know, I was like, what? And then I saw that all these other people were posting, oh yeah, it's the same at my kid's school too. It's the same at my kid's school too. It's the same at my kid's school too. I'm like, oh my gosh, there are so many things that we just go, okay, well, this is our normal. So how are we going to cope with it? So I totally, yeah, hear you on that.
Well, let me unpack that even a little bit more.
Yeah.
It's not just that it's become normal. We are not seeing it as the abuse and exploitation and misuse that it is, yeah. You know? And because I think about, all right, let's just use greed for an example. Greed used to be one of the seven deadly sins. Okay. Abuse and exploitation, in my mind, you know, maybe it's my Christian background, right? I think most of those things are probably would fall under the category of sin. Mm-hmm. If we looked at these things we have normalized and we said, yeah, that's abuse. Yeah, that's exploitation. That's probably even a sin. Would it allow us to draw the line and set a healthy boundary and stop us from going along with this manufactured consent? I wonder about that, you know, but they are manufacturing our consent to endure all of this. I mean, think of the psychological effect on these kids. That's abuse. That is mental abuse. Right. But that's not how it's couched by the people who just think the answer is more guns.
Right, right. Absolutely. Well, and I feel like we're kind of already, we're dancing around this, but I want to go back and pick up the thread too of, you know, how you got here. So tell me about, the goddess work, you know, this is very clearly your path. And then, tell me about that. Tell me about how you got to where you are now.
So, all right. So I'm into goddess spirituality for a good long time. I've, you know, done some books, you know, doing the sacred tour, started a nonprofit, have the podcast, and I learned so much from these people on my shows. But I think it was really the social justice aspect of it that really shifted things for me, because I really started to understand that these values that are come under the sacred feminine umbrella that have been denied us in patriarchy, that have, you know, we've been told are weak, you know, that, you know, those can't possibly be at the center of our culture. Those were the things that were so desperately missing from society. Just like goddess and a feminine face of God was missing from society. And I started to realize the importance of restoring those values and the sacred feminine, whether she be a deity, whether she be an archetype, whether she be an ideal. I started to realize the importance of restoring that to the center of our culture so that we start to shift our consciousness and get away from tolerating, you know, these abuses and these exploitations. I felt like she was the answer to the world's woes, right? Mm-hmm. So I got more into the idea of, activism and then what color candle to use on the altar for Beltane kind of a thing. You know,
yes.
And so it became so much more important than just the, you know, the wheel of the year or, we learned about a new goddess in this obscure country. And, you know, look, there's a new Venus discovered, when she's 40,000 years old. You know, it became so much more than history, mythology. Even, you know, a spirituality with the wheel of the year, it became, this can change the world. This can make life so much better for the most of us, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, got me in, you know, to become a feminist, got me into the political arena. And so that colored how I saw goddess as well. But, But you know, this stuff doesn't pay the bills. This is my passion. This is my service in the world. I had a job. And at my job, I was attacked by a young woman wielding a stun gun. And I didn't realize the psychological effect that had on me. It turns out I found out a few years later I actually had post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And while I was trying to work through all of those symptoms, you know, anxiety, nightmares, my world shrinking, I was afraid to do my public work, all of this sort of stuff. I mean, you know, there were days I didn't change my clothes for 3 days, you know. My husband fell and hit his head and incurred a brain injury. And that, you know, those 2 days, you know, the stun gun incident, the brain injury, those 2 days changed our lives. And we lost everything. We lost our jobs. We lost the roof over our head. We lost our identities in a sense, you know. We lost our income. I don't know if I said that. And we also, to a certain extent, lost our friends because we had to move out of Los Angeles where we lived. We couldn't afford to live there anymore. And we ended up isolated on a mountain, and we were there for about 3 years. And it, you know, pros and cons. It was way too isolating, but it kept us safe during COVID. It helped life quiet down so we could heal, think, reflect, maybe do things we needed to do to restore ourselves. I also went through my second Saturn return up there, which made me reflect back on my entire life, things that I normalized that really was abuse. And
And actually, can I ask you just real quick for
sure.
listeners who might not know what a Saturn return is? Can you tell them so they know?
Yeah, so we have our first, it's sort of it's an astrological term. I mean, I'm not an astrologer, so I'm going to do my best to tell you how I understand it. It's an astrological term that we have our first Saturn return around the age of 30. And we tend to reflect on our life up until then. And I realized that at my first Saturn return around 30 was when I had this big upheaval and left Louisiana, went to California, and life changed. You know, it was a big external and internal shift. But the second Saturn return at about 60, 58, 60, that was another shift because here we had just lived that last 30 years as goddess advocates and alternative spirituality, feminism, all of this. But now here we were, having suffered these two things. COVID is, you know, COVID is happening. It really made me look even deeper. Even deeper. And that's when I realized about this normalizing abuse, you know, and I felt like, yeah, we know about patriarchy, we know about predator capitalism, but are we looking at this deep enough? Or are we seeing that we are just, we're not calling it abuse, we're not calling it exploitation. We are, you know, we are enduring it to survive. And maybe that's a credit to our resilience, but we really shouldn't be. You know, we should be setting these boundaries, recognizing this stuff for what it is, instead of continuing to deteriorate, I thought, as society and humans. And so that, you know, was sort of the catalyst for, you know, for writing this last book that just launched. May, this month actually, May's Mental Health Awareness Month. And but it, you know, it felt like to me we really had to look deeper at this stuff and not just say, well, humans are violent and this is just the way it is, this is our new normal, and just be led like sheep, you know, to the slaughter, metaphorically. Because I felt like that's what we were allowing. And maybe it had to also do with living through those years under a Trump administration, all the norms that had been destroyed that sort of upheld democracy, you know. I mean, I know there's lots of problems, you know, in politics, but and you know, and there's these ideas that maybe it has to be you know, it has to collapse in order to rebuild something. But I started to think, if it collapses and people like him are in charge of rebuilding it, we're in trouble, you know. So I don't know, did that answer your question to, you know, that next transition?
Yeah, it did. And I was thinking as you were, I want to hear you just talk more about this, what you consider to be, like, how are you defining abuse? And, you know, just go into that a little bit more. But I what was coming up for me as you're talking about this is that not only are we normalizing abuse, but we turn it into entertainment. I mean, that's the wild thing to me. Like, I still am amazed that maybe it's still going. I don't watch this stuff, but like, there's like a whole show called like Special Victims Unit, which was just dedicated to like creating entertainment out of rape. Every week there's like a show about rape, and it's entertainment to see how I think mostly women are assaulted. Like, what the heck? And that's just one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are probably millions of different ideas. Okay. And I'm not sure that millions is an exaggeration, but you think about how reality TV desensitized us to just how we treat each other.
Yeah.
You know, but remember Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous?
Yeah.
I think that started to normalize greed. You know, and we don't realize it in the moment, right? I mean, look, I hate to say it, it's horrible. My husband grew up a wrestling fan. You know, he was a gymnast and a wrestler in school, and so he would watch these horrendous shows on TV with the wrestlers. Well, you know, they legitimized and gave license to lying, cheating, abusing one another. I think these things influence us.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, so there was like nobody out there still saying, you know what, this isn't how we function in a decent society. You know, instead,
yes,
all of these misuses of each other were being normalized, and we give license to them. Plus, I really do believe, I've started to think now, whenever I see someone behaving badly, and my first go-to used to be judge them, and maybe they need to be judged. But now I think, what happened to that person? What made that person the way they are? And I would be willing to bet that if they were honest, they were probably an abused child. You know, in researching this book, I realized, I mean, these weren't things I made up. I looked at scientific studies. Some doctors even believe that the contractions a baby goes through in the womb being born affect the child, traumatize the child, affect them, and in a sense, it predisposes them to, potentially tolerating trauma and abuse, or scars them in some way. So then if they grow up in a household that's an abusive household, you know, it started from the beginning. You know, we think about the stress pregnant women are under. You know, maybe they're standing on their feet all day till they're 8 or 9 months pregnant. That affects the embryo, you know, that affects the baby, you know.
Yes.
There's so many things that we just think is okay that sets us up to be traumatized. And I believe that these people that tolerate these Trump rallies or laugh at these Trump rallies and laugh at beating people up, or like at that CNN town hall when they laughed at E. Jean Carroll's assault by Trump, I believe these are abused, traumatized people. I really do. And I think a traumatized society elects people who are abusers.
Oh, yeah.
And I think we, you know, these people need mental health, you know, mental health help. And but it's stigmatized in so many areas of the country still, right? I believe that's why we have so many opioid overdoses, is because people are medicating themselves to endure life.
Oh, I totally agree with that. And I, I just want to go back quickly to what you were saying about contractions, because I want to make sure I understand. Is it the nature of the birth, like the stress of the birth, or because I don't, I hope what they're not saying is that just by the nature of being born, like you're predisposed to a bad experience, because that feels.
If I remember right, because it's been a long time since I read this, but I think it has something to do with the contractions. Also, just, coming out of the birth canal, that whole process is hard on the baby. It's not easy. And I believe these doctors were saying that, it can scar the baby. It's a traumatizing event, and then if the baby is nurtured and loved and, and all of that, they probably get beyond it. But say they aren't nurtured and loved and held and say they don't have a loving family, or a nurturing mother, or they're born into a family, with an abusive father or mother or siblings or whatever. In my memory of the reading, the research, that trauma at birth sort of sets the stage for that other stuff to affect you even more.
Well, and I think I wanted to go back there too, because just to say, like, as a mother who, put all kinds of crap on my own shoulders about getting it right or not getting it right, like, I want to say to women, like, this doesn't have anything to do with the way your birth experience or your choices or what interventions happened or anything like that. And I'm pretty sure that's not what you're saying either. No. We're all doing the best we can.
The physicality of a birth is what it is, whatever it had to be to birth that baby, to save both people's lives, we can't be held responsible for that. But I'm saying that once the baby's born, if it was under stress, if it was traumatized, it can be, the nurturing, the love, the mothering, that can offset any, potential damage that might have been done during that birth process.
Well, what I was going to say too, I think this is making me think back to another episode that I did with Bridget Supple, who wrote a beautiful book called The Birthkeeper of Bethlehem, which was a fictional account of Salome, Jesus's or Mary's supposed midwife at the birth of Jesus. But one of the things that she really did in that book, and she got into research-wise, as she's a birth worker too, is the layers of support that would have been around mothers when they were birthing, before, during, and after. And for the most part, we don't have those things, I think. And so whatever, and I agree with you. I think there's probably, I don't want us to get off on the tangent because I think there's so much more to talk about. I think that the idea of birth in and of itself is instructive to us about the human experience. Like it's never meant to be a cakewalk, right? We come into life, and it's a challenging, you're standing on the doorway of life and death. Like in some cases it's a challenging moment. So I totally feel that. And to your point, the way in which that is met, not by individual mothers because we're all just trying to figure out how to cope in an abusive system, as I think you're pointing out here, but the way in which that's met culturally in terms of love, nurturing, care, support, understanding, or purely clinical, now get back to work, cold, that makes a huge difference, right? Yeah. All of it.
Yeah. It just puts another straw in the camel's back, And then some people come out of that saying, well, I suffered, so why should I make it easy for somebody else? So, they're the ones that kick the dog and abuse their employees and vote for the guy who wants to cut food stamps, It has a domino effect.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and I think once you start looking, you see it everywhere. I mean, is that your understanding too? Like what you got from working on the book?
Yeah. I mean, I looked and saw it more than I wanted to look and see it, right? And I think we wear blinders. I think we're in denial, and we wear blinders and we're in denial to endure. When I wrote the book, I wrote it not just in general, I wrote it, I have a wonderful foreword from Matthew Fox talking about abuse. You know, I put my personal story in it, but I also did, you know, each, you know, like the next 8 chapters, or like abuse in academia, abuse in religion, abuse in government, abuse at the workplace, abuse in the media, you know, dot, 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 dot. Also, abuse in families, abuse in society and culture, and just looked at different things and all of these different aspects of our life that we are maybe accepting as normal, when if we really allowed ourselves, we would see it's abusive, you know. And I forgot where I was going with that. What was your question? I'm sorry.
Well, no, I think you were answering about how we see it in so many different places. And yeah, I hear you naming them. And I'm weaving in my head back the thread of the sacred feminine, because for me, when I started becoming aware of a sacred feminine force, it was kind of in the same way of through the absence of a female perspective in all these different places in which you're talking about. And it's not that I think women have, you know, I'm not getting into this whole like biologic essentialism or like whatever, that we are more cash, like we alone have a monopoly on care and compassion. And actually, I'd like to hear you talk about that. But there is a connection here, right, between this loss or this very small fraction of people being represented in these spaces and these things that underpin our culture, and the values that you see present in them, do you think?
Okay, so I'm going to answer your question. I think I'm going to answer your question, and if it doesn't, we'll circle back.
Okay.
First of all, you know, I for a long time, and I learned this in the Smith College course. For a long time, I went from being a white supremacist to a female supremacist until I realized that it's not in the genitals. It's not what gender you are. It's your belief systems. It does, you know, and I realized that because of all the toxic women I was meeting. And you look at, turn on the news, you know, you will see so many toxic women out there who perpetuate and prop up institutionalized racism, sexism, misogyny. Women do not corner the market on goodness.
Absolutely.
However, you know, as a belief system, we attribute to the sacred feminine these values that are so lacking in patriarchy, right? So I wanted to get that across, because it bothers me when I hear people say women will save the world. I think there's something to the fact that women being the life givers, women having endured patriarchy, women who 70% of them retire in poverty because they have not had equal pay all their lives, or maybe they've stayed home and they're taking care of kids, elderly parents, so they don't have a decent retirement when they reach 65. They know of life that is unfair, abusive. And so maybe it's not so much about that they're women, it's about because of the role that they have had to play in society, that they understand suffering. And that even goes back to Eve. Think about it. How many religions say, well, women should suffer in childbirth because of Eve, right? You know, how many religions say women are supposed to submit to their husbands, and women stay in domestic violence situations because of their religion? Or maybe it's because they can't make enough money out there to support themselves and get away from the abuser. You know, so I think it's more, you know, maybe women would be better to make laws simply because they have suffered more, I think, than a lot of men. You know, they have a different perspective, a different worldview, I think. But there, I think there's also something, you know, to the fact that we don't have equal representation of the genders in government. in corporations. I mean, for instance, in Scandinavian countries where their taxes are higher, but they have a great social safety net, college is free. After college, because the government has invested in you, the government requires corporations to have, I think it's 5%, was it? I'm digging deep here. It might be 5% or 10%. Require that they have women in upper management, on the CEO levels instead of on the line, So all of that makes a difference. But here we have all of these institutionalized systems that work against having a better quality of life. You mentioned, I think you, or maybe we were thinking it together, childcare. I mean, how many years have Republicans voted against having childcare? It's get back to work. You just birthed this baby and maybe you even had a cesarean, but you got to get back out at your job where maybe you stand on your feet all day. It's not like that in other Western countries. There's something wrong with Americans, I really think. We have, it's almost as if there's this masochism. And sometimes I lay it at the feet of religion because I, growing up a Christian, we looked at this guy suffering on the cross and were taught that it was noble to sacrifice and suffer. We wanted to be like him. So the, boy, that is, that is a real head trip to lay on people, right? And then when you go out into the world and you become an employee or you become a wife or, then you've already had it ingrained in you, suffering and sacrifice is good. Submit to your husband. That's what religion says. And, all of these things. So, I'm not as valuable as a man. So I shouldn't make as much money as him, even though we're doing the same job. We come into the world with these belief systems that allow ourselves to be ripe for abuse and exploitation. And I don't think we think about it that way.
I mean, and now that you're naming it, we do. I mean, I want to say too, like, and if you guys listen to the show, I typically don't touch politics much, and I think part of the reason is because I don't want people to get stuck there. I think the whole damn system is toxic, frankly, and certain expressions of it are way more toxic than others. And what I would rather us focus on, rather than defeating that group of people or defeating this person or whatever, which, that's if that's your flag to carry, I more props to you. It's not mine. Like what I'm interested in is unpacking these systems, like, and recognizing that it's woven into the system itself. And at certain times, certain people are bigger flags of it or bigger expressions of it than others. But, and so I'm curious how you would react to that, but I also am like, and then given that, like, what the heck do we do? Do you say that in your book? Do you tell us how we're supposed to deal with this? How do we fix
Well,
this?
I have some ideas, and you know what? And I give Rianne Eisler credit because Rianne more or less said something you just said. It doesn't do us any good to fight one another and be divided and have this polarity. But at the same time, we have to know who's making life harder for us when we go in the voting booth and who is more likely to support us. We can't bury that because there is this false equivalency that both sides are as bad as the other. And that's simply not true. Okay. All right. That all being said, when you encounter a situation, okay, you look at a situation. I don't care if it's the workplace, religion, academia, any of these categories, family and friends, society and culture. When you see a situation happening, I say to you, try to put your belief systems aside and look at what's happening. Is it abuse and domination, or is it love and partnership? Are we trying to create a situation where it's the we and the us, Or is it a situation where it's the I and the me, 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 me? And I think, you know, or you could even say, is it love? Or is it something that's not looking like love? And that, I think, you know, if we can really boil it down, put racism, sexism, you know, fear of gay people, immigrants, if you can put the fear aside and just look at the situation as a human being and say, is this a healthy thing to do? Is this a, did we make a loving decision here? You know, or are we just playing out old belief systems? You know, I believe that, you know, Rianne talks about the partnership way. And I teach some of her classes about learning to be in partnership with yourself, with your family and, you know, people close to you, your community, in the workplace, in society at large, deity. And you want to have a partnership, a healthy partnership, you know, with partnership for yourself. You want to make sure you're practicing self-care. And that might mean if you're working in a toxic work environment, you need to be able to be aware of that and recognize it, and then start to figure out how you're going to do something about it or get out of there and go somewhere else. You know, it may be a toxic, you know, person in your family, you know. So you got to be aware of it and figure out how you're going to deal with it, you know. So again, you know, I think it goes back to love, partnership, you know, inclusiveness, diversity, equality, versus, you know, domination, oppression, misogyny. You know, is it love, or is it something else?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it decency, or is it something else? It's not about whether, well, they deserve that, so we'll turn the other, we'll look the other way, you know,
mm-hmm.
or they don't deserve that, I do, so there's not enough for both of us, you
mm-hmm.
know, so I want mine, but I don't care if they get theirs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, Erich Fromm was this great, I think it was this German psychologist from the 40s who wrote about, you know, it's like having versus being. And I really do believe this. We are in a society that's all about having, acquiring assets, our portfolio, keeping up with the Joneses. How many pair of shoes do I have? Do I have a, you know, vacation house, you know, having versus being. In other words, who am I? What do I do out in the world? How am I of service?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think our society is one that sends us the wrong message. I mean, look at prosperity gospels, for instance. You know, how has Christianity shifted in so many places from the teachings of Jesus to prosperity gospels, which has been, if people bothered to go back and look at the history, it's about capitalism. It's Christianity's connection to capitalism and how corporations started fighting against the New Deal as soon as it was in place. You know, it's not about who has the most toys, you know,
yeah.
In your-
Well, that's actually making me think back even farther too. I had a recent guest on named Shauna Blue Star Newcomb, who whose father, she works with her father on this, but he's a legal scholar, indigenous, and has done a ton of work around understanding the doctrine of discovery and how that's actually been woven into the legal system of the United States. But I think you can go back even pre-capitalism and say, or the idea of manifest destiny, that everything is here, that the Christian God said, this is mine to take. And that, that the people that were on that land don't count, they're savages. And their resources are mine to take, and they are there to be not seen as human,
yes.
So that I can justify taking this stuff. And it has been woven into religious traditions, and that's not opinion. I mean, that you can go back and look at the record. That's really there.
That was one of the things I put in the religion section. actually, when I discovered the doctrine of discovery, which,
Yeah.
by the way, I wasn't taught in school,
Oh no.
which is, on the on I lay that at the feet of academia, right? I mean, anyway, yeah, that whole doctrine of discovery, a religious doctrine, the Pope gave these explorers the right to go to these new lands, and if they encountered people who weren't like them, they weren't Christian, then he gave them license to take what they have. And we have to look at the fact that indigenous people didn't look at the world around them as a commodity.
Right.
You
Yeah,
know?
that's another thing to, oh boy, we could just go all over here. But I mean, that's another thing to me. I recently it just occurred to me because I read a book. It was a nonfiction account of a man who lived in Maine for 27 years on technically illegal land, but he just was sort of done with society and kind of walked off into the woods with his tent and wanted to be left alone. Unfortunately, his way of surviving was breaking into his neighbors' houses and taking their food. So eventually he got caught. But what it brought up for me was this wild realization that if you want to live on the land, you can't. You're not allowed to in the United States. There is no way that you can legally do that unless you own the land. You must. And so maybe that's going to be my final question for you, because I feel like I could keep talking to you for a really long time. Maybe you have to come back. But you like in that example, you must participate in this system. It is illegal to opt out. You have to have the resources, and to have the resources, you've got to play the capitalist game. So given that, like, how do we survive it, Karen? Or, and I guess the addendum to that is like, where do you find hope for transformation?
Well, I think, and this might sound Pollyanna, but these are the best answers I have. We didn't get here overnight. All right.
Yeah.
I remember growing up, and we had decent benefits, and Christianity was not about prosperity gospels. These things have happened over time, right? I feel like we can reinvent ourselves as humans again. But we have to have some leadership. I think we have to have a goal, but before we shift, we have to realize we need to shift. Okay? So let's just say that first. We need to look at all the stuff we've been talking about, realize we need to make a shift. Okay, so we need to make a shift. What do we shift to? We shift to new ideas, new belief systems. We leave patriarchal ideas, colonialism ideas, oppressive dominator ideas behind. We think about cooperation, not competition. Okay. We think about how do all of our boats float, not just some people's. Okay, I'm getting ahead of myself. So I think it starts with self-care. It starts with ev education. We have to see the sacredness in all life, whether we're talking about, a species out there, or the fact that, the United States has one of the worst birth rates for women in the Western world. Okay. We have to think about the sacredness of all life so that things or n everything out there isn't a commodity. All right, because it shouldn't be a commodity.
Yeah.
We have to start thinking in terms of social justice. We have to think of, we have to retrain ourselves to have gratitude, because I think gratitude is a silver bullet. I think when we start to feel grateful, then we're not as fearful. And maybe we're less likely to go buy a gun and kill people. Or we're less likely to, to make laws that hurt one group of people and benefit another. I think we have to practice generosity. There's this idea that maybe a guaranteed yearly income would help. There have been experiments done in, I think it was Stockton, California, and some other places, took these low-income communities and experimented with giving them a small base income that they could depend on. And that gave them some breathing room to maybe look for another job that might be better, to maybe buy better foods so that they're healthier, to maybe have a little bit of time to have a better quality of life with their family. It reduced the stress on these people so that they had a better quality of life. I think we have to go back to, do I want to have a society where it's, you know, all about assets, or do I want to have a society where people value being in service, you know, to their community? Compassion, caring economics, which Rhian Eisler writes about. You know, our economic system is based on gross, the GDP. Well, right. The GDP is not a good indicator of if everybody's doing well. It's only right. if certain people are doing well.
Right.
You know, we can't have government telling colleges that they can't educate kids about the history of the United States or gender issues or women's studies. They, you know, that's just an attempt to make us more ignorant and pliable and manipulated.
Right. Yep.
So, but it starts with self-care, you know, with ourselves. If we need mental help, if we need support, if we need to get toxic people out of our lives, I think we have to start there. You know, if we have an abusive boss, we have to start thinking, well, I need to start looking for another job. You know, because there's so much, I think we go out into the workplace so unprepared. We might not even realize that our employer is having us do things that they shouldn't be having us do. Or they're not, I had so many, you know, I solicited examples of abuse from people for the book. And the one of the areas that I got the most solicitations from was people in the workplace. And women would say when they came onto the job, they weren't trained the same way as men. They weren't given all the information they needed in order to succeed at their job so that they would fail and be fired. You know, I mean, there's also, you know, there's ageism and, you know, at work, there's discrimination at jobs. You know, if you're in the human resources department and your employer who owns the company believes that, you know, that black people are lazy and he really doesn't want to interview black people for his job openings, what do? If you're human resources, do you go along with it to keep your job and your paycheck? Or do you look for another job? You know?
Yeah.
We make decisions every day on the job that, you know, that chips away at our humanity, I think.
Yeah. So then where are you finding hope these days? Do you have hope? Is that a word that you like?
Yeah, I still have hope. I still have hope. And it's in little things and it's in big things. In spite of everything we went through, well, first of all, I think, look, you know, I started out in this life as a racist and a white supremacist, and I learned that doesn't work. Okay. So I have hope that the same thing can happen with other people. I didn't know anything about a feminine face of God or patriarchy or predator capitalism, but I learned, and other people can too. I look at, I know we don't want to go politics, but politics is giving me hope because I see people are rejecting authoritarianism for democracy.
Mm-hmm.
I have hope with the young people, because they don't seem to have all these isms, you know?
Yeah.
Also, a friend of mine was telling me recently, she's in her 40s, she's a little younger than me. She said women are shifting and they're creating new ways of being in the world. And I thought this was kind of remarkable. You know, for instance, two women who have a platonic relationship or basically forming a partnership, buying houses together, having children. They may still date, but their priority is to their household, their partner, their kids. And so maybe they decide that, these incel men out there or this toxic masculinity that's out there, maybe if they can't find a man who wants to evolve and be a better human and expect women to have equality and all of that stuff, well, they've foregone the traditional roadmap. They still have children, they still have a house, but they're just not doing it with maybe a guy if they're hetero, because maybe they just haven't been lucky enough to meet a good guy, so they're finding alternatives. So yeah, I think the world is going to look different a few decades from now, but it looks different now than it did a few decades ago.
Absolutely. That I'll put this in the show notes. There was just an article, I think, in the New York Times fairly recently, about they called it momunes, single mothers creating communes, or momunes like going in and buying houses together. Exactly what you're talking about. I also want to put in the show notes some episodes that are just kind of sparking and making me think about this conversation. So check that out if you're interested. I know I had shortly after George Floyd was murdered, I had Letty Sullivan on, and we talked a lot about healing racial trauma and also the idea of withdrawing our consent from systems that don't represent us. And then also Lynn Twist was on earlier this year, who I think has just done some really amazing work about thinking around equity. And just the last thing that I want to say real quick is that to me, this is what it's the value. Well, okay, I'm not going to limit down to that. But for me right now, the practice of the sacred feminine is the opening of the door to having these conversations and the shift in culture that we want to see. And exactly to what you said, Karen, I mean, as opposed to candles on altars and things like that. And if that's where you are, that's cool. I'm really in working, to be in a practice of non-judgment. But for me, this is where I feel really drawn, is how does this exploration of the sacred feminine invite us to show up in the world differently and to, dream a different world into being. And so on that note, I want to thank you so much, Karen, for being here and sharing your thoughts and your wisdom. This has been a delightful conversation and just super engaging to me. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it myself.
Yeah. And Karen's latest book is Normalizing Abuse, a commentary on our pervasive culture of abuse. I will make sure to put that in the show notes so you can find it and you can find her. Go and listen to her podcast. You're back and running with it, aren't you? Voices of the Sacred Feminine.
Yeah, I would just direct people to my website, which is sort of the hub of everything. And it's my name, KarenTate.net.
Perfect. All right. And I'll put that in the show notes too. And thanks y'all for listening as always. And I'm always going to give you my plug. If you're still listening, hey, if you like the show, tell a friend, leave it a review, subscribe, do all those things and whatever else you want. If you feel so inspired. And until next time, please take very good care of yourselves, and we'll talk to you again soon. Home to Her is hosted by me, Liz Kelly. You can visit me online at hometoher.com, where you can find show notes and other episodes. You can read articles about the sacred feminine, and you'll also find a link to join the Home to Her Facebook group for lots more discussion and exploration of her. You can also follow me on Instagram at Home to Her to keep up to date with the latest episodes. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you back here soon.